Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Historian Jay Winnick has specialized in telling American history through a specific time span, a month, a year, or a couple of years, but he gives readers an understanding of what led up to that point and how the decisions and actions of that period influenced history ever after. In his bestseller, April 1865, he chronicles the last month of the American Civil War and Lincoln's assassination, and that's effect on the post-war South. In The Great Upheaval, he tells the story of a fragile new state, the first years of the United States under the Constitution. And in his latest book, he looks at the year 1944 through the eyes of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his efforts to win the war, to change a post-war world, and his failure to confront one of the greatest humanitarian catastrophes of the modern world, the Nazi Holocaust. In his book, 1944, FDR and the Year That Changed History, he asked whether Roosevelt, who he calls the greatest wartime leader since Lincoln, may have missed his Emancipation Proclamation moment, as he calls it, by not confronting the Holocaust directly and bombing Auschwitz, as Jewish leaders of the time were urging him to do. It's a fascinating look at the year and the events that have shaped our world for the next 50 years. The name of the book is 1944. Historian Jay Winnick is my guest today. Jay Winnick, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here with you.
First of all, the title of the book, 1944, as the year that changed history. Why that particular year as opposed to, say, a year like when you look at FDR's presidency, 1933, a year that has had incredible influence on the scope and dimensions of the federal government. It's changed government forever. Why 1944 is the decisive year?
Why do I choose 1944, say, as opposed to 1933? And as you say, it's when Roosevelt came to power. It's when he started to tame the Depression. And interestingly enough, it's also a time when Adolf Hitler came to power, really at the same moment. So there's a kind of curious twist to history. But what I see as so profound about 1944 are three things that were happening all at once. The first is that Roosevelt, his health was declining, and he was a deeply sick and ailing man. And in fact, he was a dying man. And he was dying just as two of the most profound events of the war were about to happen. The first was military, which was the impending D-Day invasion that would decide essentially the outcome of the war. And the second was humanitarian, arguably the greatest humanitarian crisis in the history, not only of the war, but perhaps of all time, which was the gassing of the Hungarian Jews by the Nazis. And all of this was happening at once. So that's why, in the end, when I kind of stepped back and I looked at what would be profound to write about, I chose 1944.
And there are a lot of revelations in this book or things that you bring to our attention once again about this particular year. But you begin the book with the story of Tehran, that first wartime summit with the big three, Stalin, Churchill, and FDR. And you give us a sense of FDR's character. He was a man who could charm anyone. Even his bitterest enemy would have to say he could be a charming man, even if he hated the policies FDR stood for. And you see this at work in this first meeting with Stalin. He is bound and determined to use the FDR charm on Stalin.
Right. I guess one could say he was almost like Prospero from Shakespeare, working his legendary magic. I mean, it's important to think for a minute just about this man FDR, just how extraordinary a president he was. Here he was, crippled by polio, and he couldn't walk, and yet somehow he had the world on his shoulders, and he was responsible for moving the world to kind of shape it and bend it to his will. And he was convinced that he could work his legendary magic on anyone and everyone. And this meeting in Tehran was fateful and crucial. This was the first time that the big three had met. And it was in this meeting at Tehran where they were going to determine really the timing of the D-Day invasion, which would do so much to dictate the outcome of the war. And in the first meeting that Roosevelt had with Uncle Joe, as he called him, with Stalin, it's very interesting. The two men at first paused with each other, and Stalin just stood there, and his eyes looked up and down. And Roosevelt was very conscious of the fact that Stalin was looking at his shriveled legs from his polio. Very, very interesting. But soon, once they got into things, they really let it rip. And there was really no set agenda. I mean, it was kind of freewheeling, which was how Roosevelt liked to do things. And as they kind of went back and forth to discuss tactics, to discuss strategy, to discuss whether or not there would be a second front in France and when that second front would actually be opened, and eventually they chose the beginning of June. It was very interesting that this legendary partnership that Roosevelt had forged with Churchill, well, he abandoned it briefly, literally to tease and to make fun of Churchill as a way of breaking the ice with Stalin. And Stalin, until then, had been very impassive. He had been doodling wolf's head drawings on paper, and he just seemed stern, and his countenance was anything but open and warm. But at watching Roosevelt tease Churchill, almost as you would in school, all of a sudden a big guffaw came out. He started to smile, and that was when they were able to sort of reach an agreement on the timing of D-Day and the fact that Roosevelt would then choose the commander for the forces. It would later be Eisenhower who he would choose, one of his most important decisions of the entirety of the war. And with that meeting, the stage would be set for the great events of the rest of 1944.
Also at that conference, there's one of the themes that you mentioned up front manifest itself. Roosevelt has some sort of medical episode at Tehran.
Yes, that's right. As they were talking during one of the lulls, all of a sudden great beads of sweat sort of appeared on Roosevelt's head, and he felt pain. And he started to talk, and the words wouldn't come out. He was very quickly rushed to the back room or to another room where he was examined by his doctor, Dr. McIntyre. And McIntyre, who often underplayed things with Roosevelt, really keeping things not only from the American people but Roosevelt himself, said it was really nothing more than an attack of indigestion. So after about 10 minutes of resting, Roosevelt finally started to right himself and started feeling better, and he went back to the actual meeting itself. But more than anything else, this was an omen of things to come. Roosevelt was sick, and much sicker than anybody realized, and in fact, he was really a dying man.
Now, did he know that he was a dying man? Because you tell us about the doctor's examination of Dr. Bruin, who McIntyre brought in. He said, this man's in congestive heart failure, he has high blood pressure, he has coronary artery disease. He's got a year, tops, which was pretty close to being true. Do we know if Roosevelt actually knew this information, or did he just discount it?
Well, here's Roosevelt, who had tamed polio, who had tamed the Depression, who was leading the Western world in the struggle against Nazism and Adolf Hitler. And I think he had the feeling, as all great leaders do in history, that he was virtually invincible. But the fact was is that he really was very sick. When he was in his office in the White House, in the Oval Office, he would often doze in his chair. He could barely write his signature. It was a little more than a scrawl most of the time. I mean, remarkably, several times the Secret Service came into the Oval Office, and they were stunned to see that he had fallen out of his chair and was lying helplessly on the ground. And then he had this hacking cough that just wouldn't go away. He had a fever that went up and down, and that wouldn't go away either. And normally the stoic Roosevelt never let on about how he felt, but when somebody said, how do you feel, Mr. President, he would usually say rotten or like hell. So when he met with Dr. Bruin, and the reason why he met with Dr. Bruin is because his daughter was so concerned by what was taking place, and she really felt that the White House doctor, McIntyre, was really sort of underplaying things. So they decided to give him a whole workup at Bethesda Naval. And interestingly enough, at no point did Roosevelt even evince any interest in what the diagnosis was. But it was congestive heart failure along with a whole slew of other maladies. And I think he just thought he could soldier on. But in the final analysis, he wouldn't be able to soldier on, but he would take the Western world through this most pivotal period despite his health. One other thing I'll say is that when D-Day was about to happen, he was hoping that he would be able to go to London and be with Churchill, but his health wouldn't permit it. Mm. And indeed, he was so sick before the D-Day invasion, under doctor's orders, he was told to take some time out to recuperate. Otherwise, he would really be in bad shape, i.e. he wouldn't make it through the year. So that was when it was decided he would go down to South Carolina. He would try to resuscitate himself at Bernard Baruch's estate. He had planned to go down for only 2 weeks. In the end, he stayed for a full month.
The other thing your book talks about is what you consider this great humanitarian failure of the United States and of FDR in 1944. By 1944, it was obvious that the final solution was underway in Nazi Germany and in Poland in the East, that Auschwitz. And you lay out this sometimes hard-to-read account of what life was like in Auschwitz. And this idea of this failure to bomb Auschwitz when people brought this idea to the government, why didn't FDR take action on this?
Well, this really is, in a sense, one of the great puzzles. Here you have Roosevelt, the world's foremost humanitarian, facing the foremost humanitarian crisis that history has ever witnessed, and he flinched, and he shirked from doing anything. And the puzzle is why is that the case? And I think it's safe to say that Roosevelt himself perhaps gave the answer. He said the best way to help the Jews was to win the war as speedily as possible. And it was that single-minded focus that he just was not going to waver from. But the thing was is that he had other people bringing him information. What it was important for the listeners to understand here is that the final solution, in the beginning, it was enshrouded in the greatest of secrecy. Hitler understood that the Western world would not countenance such barbarity and literally the wiping out of an entirety of a people, the Jewish people. And yet, since 1942, in drips and drabs, increasing amounts of information kind of came out. And by 1944, there really was a good picture of just the full scale of the savagery and the barbarity and the horror of the gassing of these Jews who one by one were being killed. I mean, just think about this. As many Jews would be gassed in 1 hour in Hungary as died in the entire first day at D-Day. That shows the kind of speed and the scope and the savagery of the final solution. And so the question becomes, could Roosevelt have bombed Auschwitz? They had liberated Italy. They got the airfields at Foggia. Their bombers could fly those great distances. And it turns out that bombers are flying routinely over Auschwitz itself as part of the oil war, which was intended to degrade the infrastructure of the Nazi war machine. Yet we never formally made the decision to bomb Auschwitz. And all sorts of reasons were given, and I can talk about those reasons. But the irony is at one point Auschwitz was bombed, but it was bombed by mistake. And what happened when it was? Well, these inmates, and as you said, Rich, you said that I write about this in great vivid detail, and I do that because I think it's important to kind of recall just the horror, the full horror and the scale and the scope of what was done to the Jews who were worked to death as slave laborers or who were led, whether they were little children or the elderly or mothers or grandfathers, who were led to their deaths in the worst way in these horrid gas chambers. It's important to recall that. And yet, when Auschwitz was bombed by mistake, their response was to cheer. As Elie Wiesel, the great Nobel laureate, said, and he's a survivor, he said, "We were afraid of death, but not that kind of death." Hmm. In other words, they welcomed the American planes. Theirs was a refrain that we see today on the lips of refugees streaming into Europe, in a sense. They said, "When will the Allies come?" And in the case of World War II, they were saying, the Jewish prisoners, they said, "When will the Americans come?" It's very poignant, I should say.
Yeah, and you sort of lay out the way the American government found out about the final solution. And they had a telegram as early as the end of 1942.
Yeah, this is something worthy of a thriller or a Hollywood movie. There was a man named Eduard Schulte, who was a German industrialist, and he was a rare breed in Germany. He was very highly placed. He had even met Hitler once. And yet he was a fervent anti-Nazi. He despised the Nazis, thinking of them as nothing but thugs and monsters who would ruin not only Europe, but Germany itself. And in one day, he was at this elegant party given by Heinrich Himmler, who was the architect of the final solution, which was designed to wipe out all the Jews. And here were men in their finest suits and women in wearing their furs and their diamonds. And then in hushed tones, for the first time, Schulte heard about this attempt to destroy, through industrialized means, every Jew on the face of Europe, if not the face of the planet. And he was so horrified that Schulte resolved that he would risk his life and again, this reads like a mystery or like a thriller, that he would risk his life, he would go to Switzerland, and he would meet Jewish contacts and tell them about what was going to unfold. And as he put it in his words to a Jewish contact, he said, there will be giant cemeteries. He said, somehow we have to get the word to Roosevelt as quickly as possible. And they did get the word to Roosevelt. And then from there, it was clear something was happening. But as Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, a very influential Secretary of the Treasury, and one of Roosevelt's best friends said, he called that those terrible 14 months, because for 14 months, despite the information that the government now had, it did nothing.
You also tell the story of Rudolf Verba, who escaped Auschwitz, got to Slovakia, again, got information to the government of, you know, he was a eyewitness to what was happening, and yet nothing happened.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, what Eduard Schulte, the German anti-Nazi industrialist, wanted to start, Rudolf Verba wanted to finish. Verba was an inmate at Auschwitz. He was one of the rare few who was given an administrative job as opposed to being taken to the chambers or worked as a slave laborer. He was young. He was 19. He was very healthy. He had a phenomenal memory, and he knew everything that was taking place. And in a daring escape, he and a friend also from Slovakia, that's where they both came from, they hid out in the woodpile cavity just outside the inner gates of Auschwitz, and they were there for 3 days, and there was this massive search by the SS and by the Gestapo, by snarling dogs, and for 3 days their life was in peril, but somehow they eluded their would-be assailants, and then they made it through the gates of Auschwitz itself, and then for one very powerful moment they turned around and they saw these flames, these great plumes shooting up into the sky 30 feet, those were the crematorium, and then they turned around and they never looked back. And for 17 days, they eluded Nazi patrols, they eluded anti-Semites, they eluded wild animals. They were exhausted, they were hungry, they were unwashed. But eventually, they got to Slovakia, where they laid bare in all the greatest detail what was taking place at Auschwitz itself. And very quickly, the shortened version of this, what was called the Verba Memo, made its way to Washington, where it ultimately landed on the White House desk. And then soon thereafter, the full 30-page memo would make it clear what was taking place. And it was at this point that the humanitarian community just began begging to do something. Bomb the railways to Auschwitz, which, by the way, this Pope Francis, said should have happened. Mm-hmm. And then they said, bomb the camps. And yet, at the War Department, excuse after excuse was given. One excuse was that the planes couldn't fly that far. But of course, as I said, they'd been flying routinely over Auschwitz as part of the oil war. It was said that it would be a diversion of resources that they couldn't afford to do. But in fact, FDR was willing to divert resources to help out the Polish Home Army, which rose up against the Nazis in Warsaw. And he did this despite the fact that he knew whatever help they gave, it was going to be a futile gesture, that the Polish Home Army would be cut to pieces, and they were. But he did it because he wanted to send a signal to the world that we didn't countenance them being cut to pieces without the help of the West. And so one has to ask a question, why didn't we try to make a comparable symbol to the world, that we just would not stand for the barbarity of Auschwitz, the dreaded symbol of the final solution? But again, it didn't happen. And then at one point, John J. McCloy, who was the point man on this in the War Department, and McCloy is one of the legendary wise men who has been written about many, many times, and he was also the man who was responsible for the internment of the Japanese during World War II as well. So he was the man there for the tough jobs. And he said that if we were to bomb Auschwitz, it would provoke even more vindictive action. Well, one has to ask, what's more vindictive and little children being led to the gas chambers?
Right.
So it's a profound moral. You know, Roosevelt was one of the greatest presidents we've ever had. He was a great wartime leader. But for some reason, this was a profound moral blind spot that he had.
My guest today is Jay Winnick, a historian, author of April 1865. And his latest book is titled 1944, FDR and the Year That Changed History. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I hate to bring this up, but there were instances, you know, the Hudson River Valley was, let's put it that way, in the 20s and 30s and the 19-teens, It was not a hospitable place for Jews. Anti-Semitism in those upper classes were pretty rampant in the United States in the first part of the 20th century. Do you think that had anything to do with it?
I think it did have an element to do with it. I don't think Roosevelt was anti-Semitic, not at all. I mean, maybe when he was younger, he was a prisoner of his social class, or even Eleanor, who later became a great friend of the Jews.
She's quoted as saying some pretty horrendous things about Jews in her early life.
Yes, she certainly is. I mean, at one point, she talks about how horrible it was going to that Jew party. Yeah. And she didn't like Bernard Baruch because he was too Jewish. But I think it's safe to say that by the time World War II rolled around, any vestige that they might have had of even the faintest whiff of what one might call anti-Semitism was not there. I mean, Roosevelt had a number of Jewish advisors. Eleanor herself lamented that the failure to do more for the Jews was the thing that she regretted more than anything else. But on the landscape within America, there's no doubt that anti-Semitism was still significant. There's no doubt that the State Department was tinged with anti-Semitism. In fact, Breckinridge Long, who was the head of the Visa Department and who put up every roadblock he could to keep the Jews from coming into America, even as they were cramming the consulates, and of course by not giving them visas, it amounted to a death sentence. He was later accused by Henry Morgenthau as being anti-Semitic. Morgenthau confronted him directly and said, "Frankly, Breck, many people think you're anti-Semitic." Hmm. And then what I think should have happened is that Roosevelt should have used his enormous prestige and his powers of persuasion to rally the American people behind doing more. But he never gave a fireside chat. He never gave one major speech about it. He was afraid of turning this into a war for the Jews, perhaps. But when one considers what was taking place with the Final Solution, and in fact, in the end, when they liberated the camps, Dwight Eisenhower said, "Well, finally, we now, and the American soldier knows what we've been fighting for." I think that Roosevelt could have used his enormous powers of persuasion, certainly by 43 and by 44, to rally the American people behind that.
Now, if we can switch to a different subject in our last couple of minutes, one of the things your book also does is talk about, you know, when we think about the American sort of military planning during World War II, we think of General Marshall, who many thought would lead that invasion, and Eisenhower, Roosevelt thought he was too important to leave Washington, and he was so necessary for the total war effort. He appointed Eisenhower instead. We think of General Eisenhower and his ability to soothe allies and make the D-Day invasion a success. But you say that Roosevelt also deserves a lot of credit. He had a very keen military mind. In fact, you outlined the decision at the very beginning of the war to go to North Africa as opposed directly to Europe. You said that was a brilliant decision by him. The military wanted to go to Europe, but that Roosevelt thought that the Army was not ready to tackle Europe yet.
Yeah, no, Roosevelt, I think, was a brilliant military leader. I mean, really, the finest military leader we've had in this country, along with Abraham Lincoln. And what he did in 42 was really a masterstroke, and it was his and his alone. The military was keen, under Marshall and Eisenhower, on having an invasion as early as 1942, One great and grand tank battle on the open plains was what they envisioned. And Roosevelt understood that we weren't ready for an invasion yet. We had to gear up our arsenal of democracy. We were still a good year and a half away. But by the same token, he believed we had to do something. We had to be in a fight. We had to help the morale of our allies, both Britain as well as the Soviet Union. And so he signed off on the North Africa campaign, which was that we would land in North Africa and then we would get a foothold there. And Eisenhower called the decision to do that the blackest day in American history. But of course, it turned out that Roosevelt was right. This was the perfect thing to do. And it helped our American soldiers, who were very green, helped them get some important seasoning for the war. And it did boost morale. And at one point, Marshall said, he said, "Well, we failed to understand just how much the American people have to be entertained." Well, entertainment was an inelegant euphemism for morale. And then a few other things that Roosevelt did were just sheer brilliance. Again, it was out of his fertile imagination that came the Lend-Lease, which was the vital lifeline that kept alive both the Brits as well as the Soviet Union. And he did that without really input from his staff. It was out of his fertile imagination, along with Churchill, that came the Italian campaign, which was the prelude to D-Day. I mean, time and again, you see that Roosevelt made the key decisions and the right decisions, and he made them on his own. He made them without the benefit of his advisors or by overruling his advisors. He was really a great strategist.
Earlier, you alluded to the situation today in the Middle East with ISIS and the refugees from Syria and from various places in conflict in the Middle East. What can we learn from FDR in 1944 that applies to this current contemporary situation?
Well, I think what we can learn is that leaders are judged not simply by what they do militarily, but what they do in terms of humanitarian actions. They're judged by their action or their inaction. And, you know, when one thinks about when one looks at the refugees streaming today, it calls to mind what Roosevelt faced. In 1939, for example, there was a ship, St. Louis, that was bearing 973 Jews seeking asylum in the United States. And the ship sailed up into the shores of Miami, close enough that they could see the flickering lights of buildings. And they cabled Roosevelt urgently and desperately asking for asylum, and yet they received no answer back. And eventually they were sent back to Europe, where about a quarter of the ship was killed in the Holocaust. So these moral issues, these humanitarian issues, really have consequences. And when we bear in mind some of the, I guess, failures of policy that are on our lap, I think it suggests to us that today it's important to exercise not just military leadership for military issues, but humanitarian leadership as well. And I think it's safe to say that leaders, after they're out of office, they sometimes feel that if they fell flat on one thing, it's on humanitarian actions. For example, Bill Clinton said that his failure to act in Rwanda was one of his greatest mistakes. And it really is kind of a warning signal to us: do something when it comes to humanitarian issues. History demands it. Humanity demands it. Morality demands it.
Mm. The name of the book is 1944, FDR and the Year That Changed History. Jay Winnick, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I love your station, and this was a terrific interview.
Historian Jay Winnick speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled 1944, FDR and the Year That Changed History. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.